Good evening. We have just a minute before we start, so I will mention this handout. A lot of you have been coming over and over, so you're tired of me hearing, saying this, but we have a handout in the back of the class that goes over the readings for this class and where to find them. A lot of them are online, and then there is a great big book. We have been we've had assignments from this book for the last couple classes, and plus this one, there's some assignment from this book, Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand. That'll continue. So most of the modules after the first couple have assignments from here, so you'll get a lot out of this if you get that. And then we have this tiny little book for this class as well, which Jill just said you get if you do Refuge. So you can recommend whatever, if people have this or not. There is a Refuge ceremony. If you've never taken Refuge before and you want to take Refuge for the first time, that's why this class is being done in the order that it's being done, and that is on June 10th. And maybe Shanka can mention that we tend to ask for Refuge, so it's not like there's a sign-up or you just don't just show up, but you would want to talk to Donna. You're not on a mic, but... but maybe when class starts, or if I can give this to you.
Do you want to ask for
I'm just letting them know that that the tradition.
Right. So teachers don't just give Refuge, right? The students have to ask for it, you know, historically multiple times before they actually give Refuge. In any case, so on June 10th is an opportunity for you, if you so want, to ask for formally take refuge into the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, right? Like that we've been talking about, right? Which officially makes you a Buddhist. So that's the only thing that's required to be a Buddhist, is to take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So usually it basically, we'll talk about during this class, what are the benefits of taking refuge, why, and so forth and so on, right? Taking refuge means that you are committing to following the path, right, to the best of your abilities, and that you are forsaking other, I don't want to say paths, but other objects of refuge, let's put it that way, right? So for Hindus, that would be, whatever God you pray to and so forth and so on, right? You don't have to take refuge. And that booklet is, you can get that booklet from the bookstore and you can look through it and you can see what it's about, the booklet's not a secret, so you can get it. And what it entails, the refuge ceremony itself entails, is that it will happen basically before dawn, okay? So I'm assuming Geshe-la is doing that, right? So it'll happen before dawn. So, basically everything has to finish before dawn. Dawn nowadays is around, 5:45, something like that? So you have to come about 5 o'clock probably, something around that time. And, there's some prayers and then there's some prostrations and you follow some English and Tibetan with Geshe-la and that's it, right? There's no vows or anything. This is not a, tantric commitment or something like that, right? What else? Oh. And the good thing about taking refuge, this is taking refuge for the first time, which you have to do from a qualified master, right? So Geshe-la is a qualified master. Some high students are qualified masters, and, you know, of course, Rinpoche and so forth and so on. After that, on, you know, auspicious occasions, you can take refuge by yourself. Once you have taken refuge from a qualified master, you can take refuge by yourself again. You know, like, sometimes they say that, you know, one of the, well, for example, one of the, you know, you'll learn this, but one of the ways purification practices, the Vajrasattva practice, right? So one of the things you do in there is take, you know, there's four things you do. And one of them is take refuge, right? So if you wanted to take formally refuge, right, then you can just do it by yourself. You don't need a qualified master if you've already, you know, gotten the transmission, right? Because the refuge is the transmission of the lineage. That's more than I would.
No, that's perfect. That's great on the motivation and that. And then also from a logistic standpoint, Donna has to know that you're coming. So please get in touch with Donna Cease, the spiritual program coordinator, if you would like that to take that opportunity. It's not like your Evite, yeah, where you're like, maybe I'll come.
Well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you can just repeat the question.
The question was, are we asking Geshe-la? Well, you're asking Geshe-la through Donna. That's why you talk to Donna.
And I think we'll have more time. Yeah. June 10th. Which is Sakadawa, and then later that night is our gala, so that's on a Saturday. That's a refuge before dawn, and again, get in touch with Donna and find out more. So this was just meant to be an announcement. I know we want to, well, yeah, it's going to be a big day. So anyway, this handout has more about this class in particular. If you are keeping track of everything you're doing, there's a space on the back to do that. If you want to get a certificate for this class, or maybe if you took the other one with Shanka, one part of the certificate is coming to the classes. So if you're coming to all of Shanka's classes, you want to finish up the reading and the other things so that he can sign your certificate. Or you just keep track of everything you did and be happy about it, or you keep track of everything you did and get the next teacher to sign off on it when you come to these classes again, because a lot of people keep coming. But that's what I would say. If you did how to meditate with Shankar, if you're doing this class and you want to tie up those loose ends and fill out that certificate, you know, use this time to finish that up. And we can officially start class.
Is it working now? Okay, there we go. So last time, well, I usually forget to give the, you know, what the readings, right? So I'm going to do it now while I remember. So maybe for next time, if you could, you know, there's the, well, you could just do the first reading. That's 6 pages. That's not too bad. Seeking an inner refuge, you know, in the readings. And in the liberation book, you know, in this book, pages 352 to 357. So yeah, that's basic, kind of like the introduction, things we've talked about, but it's good to kind of get an understanding from the source itself. Yeah. Okay. So let's do a short meditation. Is anybody coming for the first time today? Oh, you are. Okay. And you. Have you guys sat before? Like meditation? None. Okay, no. All right, so then I'll just say a few words. So we're going to do a silent breathing meditation for maybe 5 minutes or so. And it's just to cleanse the energies, you know, that's been rattling around in our mind stream through the day. And get ready, you know, to clear our minds to receive, you know, to be able to understand the teachings or focus on the teachings. And the main thing is to, if you're sitting, or whether in a chair or on the cushion, is to keep your back straight, but with a natural curvature. So, you know, find the right spot. And for those of you who've been around and you know the 7-point, you know, lotus posture, you can go through the points and, you know, do that. And we'll just do a meditation on the breath. So we'll focus our mind on the breathing. So as you breathe in, you feel, you know, the air going into your nostrils, you know, whether it feels cool or warm, as it goes up into your, through your sinuses, I guess, down into your lungs, it inflates your lungs, your tummy rises. And then it comes out again. So basically just try to keep our mind on that physical object, the breath, for 5 minutes. And if your mind wavers, just bring it gently back to the breath. So it's relatively simple. So we'll do that for 5 minutes. And then maybe we'll do a meditation on refuge for a few more minutes. So, so it's important that we contemplate on the on how we experience suffering. We spoke about this last time. It's not obvious to our minds that we suffer at all. Maybe we think our life is pretty good, but that's not the case at all. So you can think about in this life what problems maybe you've had, big problems that is. Hopefully you overcome them. Maybe there are problems that are going on right now. Disappointments. Your relationships that dissolve and setbacks and careers and family members who are dear to you, who are suffering. So many things like that that we experience in this life. But as the Buddha said, we've been going through this since beginningless time, over and over again. So think about it. Millions, trillions, quadrillions, however many lifetimes. Maybe not in human form necessarily, but lifetimes of birth, old age, sickness, emotional pain, physical pain, and then finally death. And then again, and again. So that's been our trajectory. And the Buddha also said that there is a way out of this suffering. And that's the Dharma that we spoke about, his teachings, step-by-step instructions and realizations to erase the delusions in our mind stream that produce this suffering continuously, and once and for all we can cut it at its root and never have to suffer again. So who could we, you know, when you really realize the suffering that we experience and have been experiencing and will experience, if you truly get that realization, then you you really want to get out of it. You know, you just realize that I have to get myself out of this mire. And who do I go to for help? So I go for refuge to the Buddha, to his teachings, the Dharma, the spiritual community, the Sangha. So the Buddha is the doctor, the teachings are the medicine, and the Sangha is like the nurse who nurses us back to health. So that's when we take refuge with Geshe-la or a qualified master. That's the motivation with which one takes refuge. A motivation of renunciation. That after examination, I have decided that this path is the right path, is the correct path for me, and I'm making a commitment to follow this path. And I'm following this path not just for my own benefit, that is, to relieve myself of this suffering, to attain nirvana, you know, liberation, but, you know, there's so many other souls who are suffering in the same way. So how can I possibly just do it for myself in a selfish way? I have to help them as well. So I'll bring them along with me. So that's the mind of great compassion with which we go for refuge. That our ultimate goal is to benefit all beings, regardless of their color, their creed, friend or foe, etc. And that's all, also the motivation with which we start any practice or, you know, study and so forth and so on. So, you know, regarding my, you know, when Aaron asked me to talk about refuge, Geshe-la, you know, giving us the opportunity to take refuge, one thing I wanted to mention is that, and Geshe-la mentions this on Sundays, is that, you know, if you, whether you've been here, whether you're first time here or whether you've been here many times, our job in the center is not to turn you into Buddhists, right? That's not our goal. So, you know, if you take refuge, certainly you are formally, you know, can call yourself a Buddhist, but that's not our goal. You know, there are, you know, it's just to benefit. It's for our own benefit that Geshe-la is giving refuge, right? And so I just want to make sure that everybody understood that, right? So there's no reason to take refuge if you, you can continue to gain benefit from the teachings without taking refuge, right? So. Okay. So, last time, I gotta find my way here. So, last time we kind of set the stage, right, for why refuge is important, right? What taking refuge means and why it's important. Maybe we have talked about it to some degree, but especially we talked about how we experience suffering, right? Because it's important to understand that, right? There are those three types of suffering. Because without it, you know, I mean, that understanding is a catalyst for us to continue on the path, right? Because if we think that, you know, if things are hunky-dory, then there's no incentive, right, to engage in virtuous behavior, to, you know, to be generous, to be kind, to be compassionate, you know. I'm having a good time, so why do I care about anything else, right? But of course, underneath it all, while I'm having a good time, there's great suffering, which we don't realize, right? So that's why it's important to the whole idea of karma, cause and effect, and the suffering is important in this context. So, so then one of the most important things is to think about karma, and so the remembering the law of cause and effect, and having faith in it, right? Is how renunciation happens, right? So renunciation meaning where we give up, not give up worldly goods, right? Not give up our home and our family and so forth and so on, but give up the attachment to worldly goods, right? So to realize the cycle that we've been in since beginningless time, why we've been in that cycle, which is attachment, you know, one of the reasons, the main reason, I guess, and to basically generate a sense of disgust about that attachment, right? So you say, you know, I have to get myself out, and so I have to overcome this desire for whatever it is, right, that you desire. And, you know, we desire for so many things, right, wealth, you know, gorgeous men or women, you know, status. People travel a lot, right, because they just want to see new things, right, experience new things. Sometimes it's a form of escape, right? But, of course, you can't really escape. So all those things that we have desires for, right? But I can't remember what teacher said. I mean, you know, he said that you've had all those things a billion times over. That it's not anything new, you know. If you're going to Bali, it's not the first time, or nice, beautiful sandy beach. That's not the first time you're going, you know, going to a place like that, right? Or, you know, beautiful wife or boyfriend or whatever, right? So none of these experiences are actually anything new. It's just that we keep repeating the same things over and over again, and all the associated pain and suffering that comes with it, right? So the renunciation, you know, when you see that becomes a cause for refuge. And the, you know, one of the things that they say is, you know, that there's two things, it'll be in your readings, that one has to reflect on or contemplate to bring ourselves to go for, you know, to see the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha as objects of refuge. And that is two things, which are fear and faith, right? Fear is, you know, the fear or the understanding, once you think about suffering and so forth and so on, then you you know, you have this great fear that, you know, this life is going to end relatively soon, maybe sooner than we think. And after that, what awaits us? Right? Maybe a rebirth in the God realm, if we're lucky. Right? And maybe a rebirth in the hell realms if we're unlucky. So we don't know. And, you know, there are many things we've done. You know, there are many, as I said last time, there are many positive things we've done, right, in the past. And as proof of that is, they say, is the fact that we have this human life is a product of many, 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 many virtuous actions that have the result of those virtuous actions have come to fruition for us to have this human life, which is the highest form of birth one can have, right? Even higher than the God realms. But we have also, you know, because of our delusions, the heavy delusions that we have, we've created a lot of negative karma as well, right? That's sitting around in our mind stream. And so if we keep postponing making effort in the spiritual path, then it's not guaranteed that, you know, our previous positive actions are going to come to fruition again in a human birth next time, right? It could very well be that a whole bunch of our negative actions, and remember, just like, you know, we've had many gorgeous boyfriends and girlfriends in the past, we've also committed many heinous crimes in the past, right? There's nothing new under the sun, right? There's nothing that's happening in this life that we around us that's new in a way, right? These are things that have been happening forever. So we've committed all those, you know, all those pretty bad things. So, which could easily have us end up in the hell realms, right? I know that kind of the whole idea of hell realms is a difficult topic, right? So I'll say one quick thing, which is that you don't have to accept it, you know, because the Buddha said so, or because Geshe-la says so, or I'm saying it here. But certainly, you know, just examine it dispassionately, right? And see whether it makes sense. You know, go through the teachings, see whether it makes sense or not, right? If it doesn't make sense, it's okay. Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. In other words, you know, if it doesn't make sense, put it aside. That's the instruction I was given many, many years, you know, 20-odd years ago, when I was first, you know, in the Dharma. And I wasn't ready to accept hell realms either. But, you know, the other things are of great benefit, right? So you don't have to believe in the hell realms. But you can also think about it, you know, an Indian master in the, I don't know, 4th or 5th century, he also kind of like was like, does it really? Because back then they thought that the hell realms were down under the earth, right? That's what it says in the scriptures. You know, the hell realms are so many hundreds or thousands of miles below the earth and et cetera, et cetera. He's like, that doesn't seem to make very much sense for me, right? So he said that, you know, you can see hell realms on this earth, right? You don't have to go very far to see hell realms, right? I think for people who are experiencing civil war in Syria, that's, you know, I think there's a documentary called Hell on Earth about Syria. People who are going through severe mental illnesses, who have no control, right, of their minds. Right, trapped in their own minds, right? I mean, there's no way out. I mean, other than death, of course. I mean, you know, that's a hell realm right there, right? And many others like that. You know, there's many different kinds of, you know, the beggars on the streets in India with no arms and no legs. I mean, I that would be a hell realm. So there's many things like that, right? So we don't have to necessarily think about, you know, like it says, you know, in the scriptures, necessarily at this moment of, you know, our evolution, you know, all the hot hells and the cold hells and the seven hot hells and the seven cold hells and all this other stuff, right? And what happens in each. But just think that even if, you know, we could have another life, even if we have a human life, we could be, you know, spend it in a mental asylum, right? That would be a hell realm right there, right? So we don't know what awaits us next time around. So when you think about that, then you have to think, you generate this great fear, right? Because what the hell am I going to do? And that's why that meditation, people do that meditation, is because that becomes a fuel to go for refuge, right? Because the Buddha set out this path, right, on how to avoid it, right? How to, well, certainly avoid having, you know, or how to continue to have human lives, right? Continue to make progress, but not just that, to cut the root and gain enlightenment, right? This reminds me, there's an analogy they use of our condition, right? The condition of samsara, you know, the cyclic existence, right? Whether you're born as a human or so forth and so on. So it's kind of like, you know, like for the death, you know, for the meditation on death and impermanence, the analogy they use is, what's the verse goes? Our life, I'm paraphrasing, our life is like, a lamp in a howling wind, right? So it's, at any moment, it could just go, right? So that's the imagery one uses in that meditation, right? So in the meditation on, you know, refuge, and especially the one on what awaits us, the analogy or imagery they use is our condition is like, you know, there's a cliff and we are hanging on to this root, you know, from this tree that's on the side of the cliff that's about to fall down, right? And so there's the cliff, and you know, we're on a cliff and it's thousands of feet down, right? So we're kind of barely hanging on to this root that's coming out of this tree, right? And with all our might, right? And there's a rat or a mouse that's gnawing on the root, right? So that's our condition. You know, we just have only so long, right, this lifetime to really, you know, put it into practice, right? Put the action, you know, dharma into practice and to try to climb up, right? Because, you know, the falling it down the cliff is, you know, falling into the hell realms, but, you know, that's what the original analogy was, right? So that's what it's like. So that's the kind of way to think about it, right? So when you really think about it and understand it, then you gain the sense of, okay, I have to go for refuge, right? There was something else that came to my mind. Oh, anyway. So that's fear, right? And the faith part of it is in Buddhism, faith isn't like faith in other traditions, right? You know, I grew up Hindu, as I said, so I like to use Hinduism as an example because I don't want to use someone else's religion as an example. But, you know, you basically accepted, you know, the word, so to speak, because some high, you know, because the scriptures say so, or because the you know, some high holy being said so, right? Your guru says so. You know, my parents had a guru, and so we went there every once a month, and, you know, he would... Anyway, long story. But in this case, what we're talking about in Buddhism, there's three kinds of faith. And the first kind of faith is where, you know, you kind of are following the path because... You know, you trust someone, right? He looks like he's a qualified teacher and you trust him. And he says certain things and, you know, he talks about the hell realms, let's say, and doesn't quite make sense, but I'll go along, you know, because, you know, he seems to be a nice guy and, you know, he seems to have good intentions, you know, maybe he's right, you know, So that's the kind of a blind kind of faith, if you will, right? Which is okay, but that's not necessarily good, because that can be easily shaken, right? Somebody else can come tomorrow and say something else, and you go, oh, that makes sense. You know, I'll go along with that, right? So the next kind of faith is where you develop a sense of, you know, you've been studying for a while, and you've really been analyzing, and you say, I'm trying to hang on for a minute. So you've really been analyzing, and you gain some sense that, you know, that, okay, I think this is the right path for me because, you know, these things really seem to be correct, right? I've examined the teachings, I've examined what my teachers are saying, and I can't seem to find any holes in them, right? So I think this makes sense to me. I'll follow that, follow the path, right? So that's the second kind of faith. And then the third kind of faith, which is called conviction faith, is where you gain realizations on your own, right? You follow your teacher's instructions, you generate realizations, you know, realizations on death and impermanence, for example, realizations on karma, realizations on, you know, the karma is, you know, definite karma, you know, I mean, anyway, there's, you know, these meditations on karma, right? So, that karma is real, that it's, you know, that it's, every action has a consequence and so forth and so on. So those become part of you, right? So in other words, it's instinctual, right? You don't, you don't have to analyze, you know, every time you think, your actions automatically become positive after that, right? Because when it becomes, when you truly understand karma and you have gained a realization of karma, you will refrain from negative actions, right? Because you understand immediately. You don't have to analyze your action and think, oh, should I do this or shouldn't I do this, right? It's like that, right? So, or when you have realizations on death and impermanence, you know, you live every day as if it might be your last, right? So there's no time to waste. So that becomes part of you, right? So like that, so that's called conviction faith, you know, and so, and no one can shake that, right? Because you have attained a truth for yourself, right? And that cannot be negated by someone else's logic or whatever. It becomes an axiom almost for you, right? So that's the faith then, so fear kind of takes us towards refuge, and the faith, as we study, as we practice, as we listen to our teachers, see their generosity, see their kindness, see why they're here, you know, to, you know, benefit us, etc. You know, you generate this great faith. And that's kind of like the thing that continues to power the refuge. So the one kind of directs you towards refuge, and the one kind of becomes the sustenance, right, for the refuge. You know, it kind of continually basically increases your sense of refuge. And you know, refuge is a very powerful thing because because it, you know, it, because for number one, it's of great merit, right? Having refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha is of great merit, just like every other religion, you know, having taken refuge in the gods in Hinduism or in Jesus Christ or whatever, you know, is of great merit for that tradition, right? So it's of great merit, and of course, merit is what we need to, you know, gain another human life and continue to make progress and so forth and so on, right? All that only comes out of accumulation of merit, right? Because nothing happens by chance, right? Everything happens because of causes and conditions. So we have to create the positive conditions for, you know, for to ripen so that, you know, we can gain another human birth. So it's of great merit, but also because it keeps us on this, you know, it keeps us on the path, right? It keeps us on the straight and narrow. You know, we're less likely to veer from the path, right? We're less likely to be shaken and, you know, I don't know, you know, do bad things or whatever, right? Or be influenced by friends who aren't necessarily, don't necessarily have our best interests at heart, right? So that's, you know, that's a reason to take refuge. And that's one reason also, like, people take lay vows, you know, the next step after refuge, if you continue on the path, and you're not a monastic, of course, then you take what's called lay vows, right, which is a higher form of refuge, if you will. They go through this whole ceremony, and then you have to refrain from five things, you know. So those are then, you know, become another cause of merit, right, and keeps you further. Every action, they say, becomes a form, it becomes meritorious. Because even when you're sleeping, supposedly, Rinpoche said this, even when you're sleeping, if you've had, okay, the vows, what are the lay vows? You're probably wondering, okay, what are the five? So the five lay vows, if you're wondering, are no lying, no stealing, no sexual misconduct, no intoxicants, which means alcohol. I don't know if it means cigarettes or not, but I would think it does because it's an intoxicant. I guess it forms a habit, so it's an intoxicant. What am I missing? Killing, thank you. Yeah, that one. Yeah, so those are the five lay vows, right? Which are pretty easy to keep, actually, when it comes down. And some masters will, you know, when I took mine, you know, Chidden Rinpoche was on, you know, he was like, you don't have a choice, you know, these are the five. And we said, okay. Others will say, well, you know, if you really can't stop yourself from drinking sake, then, you know, which is the only thing I miss, okay, maybe you can keep the four instead of the five. Or maybe the three instead of, you know. So, yeah. Okay, I don't know about that one. I think killing and stealing and lying are probably like the basics. Those three you probably have to keep. Anyway, so those are the five lay vows. And so why am I mentioning this? I'm just saying this why, you know, like refuge, for example, with Geshe-la, what benefit is it, right? So similarly, you know, the five lay vows are like similar benefit because when you take vows, because you are, every action then becomes intentional, right? It's not that you just, you know, there's an intent behind every action, right? So then what happens is every action becomes positive. Well, unless it's a negative, you know, negative action. Negative actions don't become positive, but neutral actions become positive. Like you're sleeping. Rinpoche said, if you're sleeping, even that becomes positive. You know, normally it's a neutral action, right? But if you're in the vows, then even that becomes positive. Now, of course, the downside of the lay vows is if you do commit one of those actions, then the repercussions are higher than if you didn't have the vow, right? So it's important to keep them, right? And those are lifetime vows, so you can't, like, say, well, I'll stop today. Anyway, that's beside the point. So regarding, you know, we talked about, you know, being reborn as a human, right? And So, one of the things is that, you know, when you if you have a great sense of refuge, you know, your mind is, your mind stream is automatically directed towards positive things, right? And you are more likely to, you know, do your practice, follow your teacher's instructions, right? And all those things, right? So, you know, so without which you won't make progress. But also it creates a condition in our mind, what am I trying to say? Okay, let me tell you what Rinpoche said. So what Rinpoche said is that at the time of death, the most important thing is to have a positive mind. Okay? That's the most important thing. Because the state of mind at the time of death has a great influence on the next birth, what the next birth will be like, right? So if our state of mind at the time of death is one of great attachment, right, like, all the money that I made over the, in this life, you know, I'm having to now leave it or great regret, you know, all the things I haven't done and so forth and so on, right? If it's of attachment, then you'd be going to be born, even if you're born as a human being, you will have, you know, suffer from great attachment at that time. More likely you'll be born as, you know, one of those hungry ghosts or whatever that, you know, that are always looking for food and water but can never find it and so forth and so on, right? So, you know, but in any case, if you don't believe that, at least you can understand that the mind that you have in the next life is going to be one of, you know, great attachment that will be unfulfilled, right? So then will come disappointments, right? So, so it has a great influence. It's not the, you know, it's not what decides it. I mean, there's all these other causes and conditions from endless time, beginningless time that also comes into play, right? All together, this mishmash ends up with your next birth. So what Rinpoche said was that, and this is the instruction he gives all his students, is that at time of death, try to bring an image of a, you know, either, you know, chant mantras that help you, right? So that you can occupy your mind with something auspicious, or you visualize an image of a holy being, right? So, I mean, he was talking in the Buddhist context, so he was talking about, you know, either your teacher or the Buddha, you know, picture of the Buddha. So when you have refuge, you are, you know, it creates the conditions in our mind stream to be able to, you know, bring that, you know, to be able to do that, right? That's what I'm saying, right? If you don't have refuge, it means that you really haven't created the ground, right? The fertile soil for these other things to happen, right? So that's kind of the basis, right? So if you want to have, you know, because at the time of death, it's a very difficult time, right? Even if you're having a painless death, right? Rinpoche has, you know, he has told stories about, you know, he talks about how, you know, he travels a lot, right? So he meets people from all kinds of different countries and different faiths and different backgrounds and poor and rich and so forth and so on. And he said that of all those people, and he visits a lot of people in hospitals and, you know, nursing homes and hospices and so forth and so on. So he said that all of them, poor, rich, white, black, you know, whatever, you know, Christian or not, you know, or Buddhist or et cetera, all of them have one thing in common, is that at the time of death, there's great fear. You know, it doesn't matter what tradition you're from, you have a great fear that rises. And he's seen that. And the fear is the, you know, fear of the unknown, right? And you don't want to die with fear, because that's not a positive mental condition, right? So it's very difficult to overcome that fear. So, and to bring, you know, to chant mantras or to, you know, have an image, you know, visualize your, you know, a holy object and so forth and so on. And if you are having a death with pain, that's even worse, right? It's even more difficult, right? So what Rinpoche suggests all his students, and I tell this every class, you know, if you've taken other modules with me, you probably, you know this already, but I tell this to everyone because that's Rinpoche's instructions, is to, during this life, while we're alive, to always cultivate an image of a holy object in our mind, right? And when you're going to sleep, have that object in your mind as you're going to sleep. That's how you memorize that object, right? And in fact, sleep, when you go through sleep, there are these seven, at death, you know, there are these seven stages that our mind goes through at death. And at sleep, that's exactly what happens as well. So it's basically a small death in a way, right? So you're kind of practicing for the real thing so that you can have a positive life the next time around and keep going, right? Because, you know, unless you have created an incredible virtuous karma in the past, most likely you're not going to achieve enlightenment in this lifetime, right? I mean, I hope you do, but I suspect you won't. Just because, you know, but I don't know for sure. Maybe you will. But you want to keep making progress, right? It takes many lifetimes. So, but you can't do that without a human birth, right? That's the only form of birth that will, where you can make spiritual progress. Not even the God realms. Being born as a God is not going to help you. So, and that's another module. So I won't go into that. But, so that's why it's important to, you know, cultivate some kind of something that you will be able to do at the time of death. As an example for me, that what I have is there's a particular statue of a Buddha at this, you know, retreat center in California that I used to go to that I really like. And so that's kind of, you know, I've seen it many times, and so it's kind of engraved in my mind, so I just use that, right? And you can pick, you know, you don't have to pick the Buddha. You can pick some holy object or a saint or, you know, from your tradition, you know, that you find, inspires you, right? You know, Saint Francis or, you know, so forth and right, like that. Pick one, right? Or a mantra or something that you can do, right? So why am I saying all this? So the reason I'm saying this is because, you know, at the time of death, this and refuge is what's going to help us, right? At the time of death, or, you know, if you've gone, you guys have gone through the module on death and impermanence. Oh, yeah, it's coming up. Okay. Well, I'll tell you the three big secrets in death and rebirth, right? Death is certain, okay? The time of death is uncertain. And third one is, and at the time of death, nothing but the Dharma will help us. Our friends won't help us, friends meaning family as well. Our wealth won't help us. Our status won't help us. Nothing will help us, right? Those are the three main topics, and then there's three subtopics in each. You'll learn that in the death and rebirth. So that's why the time of death, none of those things are going to be of benefit, right? All the things we've done in this life is of no use whatsoever, right? You know, all the things that we thought were important to achieve, you know, in this life won't matter a bit. What matters is what kind of life we have led, right? Have we created positive merits, right? Have we been kind, compassionate, you know, generous, patient, so forth and so on. And, of course, the state of mind, right, at that, you know, at the time. And refuge helps with that state of mind, right? Refuge helps generate that faith in that holy object or in that whatever, right, in that mantra, that it will help us, right? And as I said, it's not just blind faith. This is conviction faith we're talking about, right? It's after examining it, doing mental arguments. Here you do mental gymnastics. You know, that's what analytical meditation is, right? Have you guys, they've talked about analytical meditation? Yeah. You did the different types of meditation, right? So that's what analytical meditation is, right? It's the going through the points, you know, and asking probing questions and try to negate them, right? You know, you play devil's advocate. You know, is this really true, you know? Is death really certain, right? What if I freeze myself cryogenically, right, and I come back 200 years from now? That's a good question, isn't it? I don't know the answer to it yet. But that's a question I ask myself, right? Anyway, yes, Mike... I know, but there are people online, you know, so that's the end recording as well. So you have to be on the straight and you have to be on the straight and narrow here.
Well, I just wanted to ask, is refuge kind of like the baptism and the Christian? I mean, you must have heard this before. I grew up in the Christian faith and walked away from that, but that was always a big thing when I was little. Whatever you do, just get baptized, preparing you for what would happen next.
Well, yeah, but is this, are we talking about baptism when you were a baby?
Well, I wasn't a baby. I was older.
But older, okay. I guess if baptism as a baby isn't quite like refuge, right? Because that's just, you're not making an intentional commitment, right? But I guess baptism as an adult, after you've studied and you've decided that that's the path that you want to follow, you know, to achieve salvation or what? And confirmation, right? Confirmation in Catholicism, right? So that's, you know, my wife was going to the conference. Anyway, that's another story. So confirmation is kind of, yeah, that's right. So that's like, that is like refuge. Yeah. Any other questions? I've been talking for a while. Oh, yes.
This is a little bit off subject, but it's also related. A lot of times, I've known a lot of people have died with hospice, and the typical thing is they give them opiates or whatever, and so like the last 10 days, they're out of it. And I just talked to a friend of mine whose dad's going through it, and he just said, you know, his dad was in pain, and so he's just out of it. It seems like it would kind of negate the possibility of having a calm death, and I'm just wondering if that's a topic that you know how to comment on.
You know, it's a good question. I mean, there's two sides to it. I mean, one is that, yes, you want to have a clear mind at the time of death, so you can do your practices, right? Whatever your teachers have given you instructions. You know, usually your teacher, during your lifetime, you ask your teacher for advice, and he tells you what you should do at the time of death, and if you have a clear mind, you can do all those things. On the other hand, I've also heard that, you know, if you're in great pain and you have the capacity to alleviate that pain, then you shouldn't suffer, right? So I don't know the answer to your question, you know. Geshe-la, you know, ask Geshe-la. That's a good Sunday morning question. Seriously, they're always looking for Sunday morning questions. Ask Geshe-la, right? That's what I would do. That reminds me about, you know, like how hard it is at the time of death. So there was a great master, Rinpoche. Rinpoche. Yes, Rinpoche. Rinpoche. And he was dying of cancer, I think. It was a very painful process, death process. And so he told his student that even he, who was, you know, if not enlightened, pretty darn close to it, he said that his mind was in so much pain, you know, mind was consumed by so much pain that the only thing he could do was just visualize an image of the, you know, that he had memorized, you know, right? That's all he could do. You know, he couldn't remember his chants, he couldn't remember half his, you know, mantras and, you know, all the things that he was planning to do and so forth and so on, right? So, but he could do that much. And he said, you know, that he told the student, and says, he said that that's good enough, you know? So, yeah, so even someone like that, of course, you know, there's some students who say, well, I mean, he was just setting an example. He really wasn't going through that. You know, he was just giving it as an example to his students, but I don't know, you know, which is, you know, but anyway. Yeah. So we talked about what brings us to refuge and what sustains us, right? The fear and the faith. And it's important to, you know, the fear is kind of, you know, it's a tough one, right? I mean, do you really want to follow a path that's based on fear, right? You could ask that question, right? But it's not quite that, right? I mean, yes, it is fear, but it's fear that leads us in a positive direction, right? That's how I think about it, right? It's not like, it's not like you live your life in fear, right? You have some fear that takes you to refuge and faith and realizations and compassion and wisdom and all these things, right? But then you don't have any fear, right? I mean, the fear is only at the beginning a little bit, right? I mean, after that, there is no fear. You're not living your life, oh my God, I'm going to end up in the hell realms tomorrow, right? I could die tomorrow, I'm going to end up in the hell realms. No, because at that point you're going to say, well, I've been taking action, right? I've been practicing the path, so I'm not worried about what's coming next, right? So the fear, so it's not really, the fear is just the kind of the fuel, yeah, the whatever, the thing that, yeah, the motivator, the thing that, you know, the bullet, what happens before the bullet goes out of the gun? You know, there's a spark and then there's some kind of powder, whatever happens, right? I don't know, I'm not a gun expert. But, right, like that, right? To propel you, right? That's what really it's about, right? So I think it's important to understand that it's not just fear, you know, constant fear of falling into the hell realms. Or any other, you know, terrible situation, you know. So let me see. What else am I supposed to talk about that I'm missing? Ah, right. So there are kind of like, you know, so there are different levels of refuge, right? And I think you probably already know some about this, but so, you know, there are those who, you know, there's three, you know, three scopes of students, you know, they talk about it, right? Have you guys talked about that in the Lumrim? Yeah? Okay. So there's, you know, the small scope, which is those who are on the spiritual path and are thinking of the next birth, right? The next, how to have a positive rebirth, right? So that's the first level, right? The small scope, it's called. Then there's a medium scope, the medium, you know, grade, I don't know, level of practitioners, who are thinking about their own liberation, right? To get out, you know, they've generated an incredible sense of, you know, realization of renunciation, right? And they have, you know, and faith and refuge, et cetera, and they have liberated themselves from all suffering, right? And then there are those of great scope who are not satisfied by their own liberation because they have great compassion for all the other beings who are suffering just like they used to. So they take a vow that they will help all those beings, right? Every animal, insect, et cetera, to also attain enlightenment, right? And before, you know, and some of them, there's, well, I can't remember, you know, but, you know, there's one famous bodhisattva who basically said, okay, I'm gonna postpone my enlightenment until everybody is enlightened, until I'm able to bring everyone to enlightenment, right? So he's not a Buddha, he's only a bodhisattva now. But anyway, so you have great compassion so you can't bear to see others suffering and you becoming liberated, right? Because that's, you know, so, So those are the three levels of practitioners, right? So, like that, you also have three levels of refuge, right? So those who go for refuge, you know, for, you know, a better birth, right, next time around, to continue on the path, right? They are not thinking of the... By the way, did you notice in those three levels that there is... If you are basically thinking about being only about this life, even if it's only, I guess even if you're a kind or gentle person, but you're only thinking of this life, you're actually not on the Buddhist spiritual path at least. Right? You at least have to think about the next life. Right? Anyway, So similarly, there's three levels of refuge, right? So you can take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha so that you can gain a human birth the next time around, right? Or a positive rebirth the next time around. Or because you have fear, that, you know, or that you really are afraid of the hell realms, so anything but the hell realms, please, you know, kind of refuge. Then there's, of course, refuge, you know, you've generated great faith, you have... you have been practicing and you have really, you know, you have, you know, generated wisdom and so forth and so on. And, you know, you take refuge for your own liberation. Right. And then, of course, you know, refuge, the ultimate refuge, which is, you know, may I be of benefit to every single being, right? Until then, you know, I will I'm dedicating my enlightenment to all those beings, right? I take refuge, you know, like our prayer said, I go for refuge until enlightenment to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. By my virtuous actions of giving and so on, may I become a Buddha to benefit all living beings, right? Right? That's the prayer, right? So that's the, you know, the highest level of refuge, right? So those are the kind of the three levels. And so along with the three levels, there are three different understandings, right, of the Dharma, right? So if you're thinking about the next life, you know, you have an understanding of karma. That's what, you know, you get an understanding of karma and you know, you understand like how, you know, negative actions have negative results and positive actions have positive results. So you say, okay, in this life, I really have to make sure that I accumulate merit, you know, gain positive, you know, do virtuous things and refrain from non-virtuous actions so that I can accumulate merit, so I can, you know, have a good rebirth, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the understanding that one has in that level of refuge, right? Or in that level of practitioner. So one who is the next level, who is thinking of his own liberation, he of course has this understanding of karma, deeper understanding of karma, but he also has an understanding of how suffering is, right? The three types of suffering, right? He has an intense, you know, realization, right? Of those sufferings, how we suffer, even without knowing. Right at this very moment, I am suffering. Right now. Even though everything's okay. Right? And we talked about that last time, right? How we suffer even though we don't know we suffer. So when you have that understanding of suffering, you generate this great renunciation. Right? I gotta get myself out of this. This is stupid. Right? I mean, this constant cycle. This is just idiotic, really, right? How could I be doing this over and over again? So you generate this great sense of renunciation, and that is what then brings us to liberation, right? For our own liberation, right? We overcome attachment, we overcome, you know, attachment, anger, you know, pride, jealousy, ignorance, you know, doubts, you know, wrong view, all those things, you know, we remove, right? Because of that renunciation. And so that's what brings us to liberation, right? And then, the ones who are in the highest form of refuge or the highest level of practitioners, they have a further understanding, right? They understand suffering, and because they understand suffering, their own suffering, right? They generate this incredible compassion for others because others are suffering the exact same way. They see the others going through endless cycles continuously over and over, right? And they think, this is how terrible it is, right? How, you know, all these beings around me, right? How can I not help them? Right, so they generate this great compassion. So that becomes their, you know, sustenance of refuge, if you will, or whatever, right? So their refuge is coming from that mindset. So that's why different levels have different understandings, right? You know, you're kind of peeling an onion at each level. Right? You gotta have and it's not like, you know, first you get to this level and then you work on all the things for the next level. You're all actually working on all the things at the same time. It's just that, where are you in your evolution? Right? I mean, it's not like you postpone, you know, suffering till you reach the first level, right? Well, that won't work because it'll take you eons still, right? So you work on everything, but, you know, But maybe you're at the first level right now, and it's, you know, and because you're understanding, you know, you have realization in certain things, but not in others, and so forth and so on, right? Like that. Oh, question. Two questions.
I might be way off here, but I've got very limited knowledge of the Hinayana tradition, but that sounds similar to the medium scope where they're seeking end in their own suffering. For themselves, more of a selfish sounding reason. That kind of sounds like the medium scope.
I used to think that too, but I have come across Hinayana practitioners or Theravadan practitioners who, you know, practice compassion and so forth and so on, right? I mean, of course, we all practice compassion, but I meant, you know, they are working on realizations and compassion. So, to be honest with you, I don't know the answer to your question. Maybe there are different lineages that, you know, even in the Theravadan tradition, you know, that only work towards their own liberation and others who actually work towards others. So, I don't know a good answer to your question. I don't know much about the Theravadan tradition, to be honest, either. So, yes.
Okay, so we start talking about rebirth, my head starts spinning, okay? And then when we talk about it in the context of, you know, Buddhism and this and these particular paths, then that seems, okay, I'm like, I start wondering about all of humanity is not Buddhist. I know that. But yet they keep populating. They keep getting, there are more and more people every day on this planet that are human. So, but they're not Buddhist. But they're being reborn as humans. So what does that mean? how does all that happen in, and how does that fit into what we're learning?
Well, that's good, right? Because that means like more people are, whether they're Buddhist or not, doesn't matter, right? They're doing good things so they can become humans, right? I don't know if that's a good reason for overpopulation, but in any case. have more children. You're bringing more, you know, more human rebirths. Yeah, right, exactly. Who needs animals, you know? Make them all humans. Well, I mean, yes, there are more people, but, you know, again, this is, well, first of all, this is only one planet, right? So remember, there are lots of other planets with possibly life forms, right? So that's one thing to consider, right? So we only have a myopic view of this, our own little planet, right? So there's lots of other planets that most likely have other forms of life, right? Which would also be considered as part of, you know, they're sentient beings that would be considered as part of the, you know, in the Buddhist path, right? You know, algae and stuff wouldn't be, but, you know, a single cell, you know, organisms wouldn't be, but if they're sentient beings, they would fall under the Buddhist umbrella, right? So, I mean, who's to say, you know, that, I don't know the answer to your question. I'm not sure I understand your question all the way, but if you're asking that, okay, if there were 100 people in the entire universe, and they, 100 beings in the entire universe, and the number of, let's say the number of people are 10 today and it keeps growing to 20, does that mean there are going to be fewer of the others, right? That's what you're asking. Is that what you're asking? Anyway,
okay. So, well, let me say it like this. Okay, so does that mean that people are in other walks of life that have never come in touch with the Dharma, that they are doing what is needed to be reborn as a human, in their own way?
Yeah, sure, absolutely, okay. Right? I mean, Buddhism, what His Holiness said is that every path is leading somewhere, good, right? Positive, right? There's not one, I mean, you know, just like one size of pants doesn't fit all, one religion can't fit all, right? So you have to have different traditions because you have many different types of minds, right? So to some people, to me, Hinduism does not work, but to almost a billion people, it really does, you know? So that's great. That works. That's fine. Right? So there are many ways to the same goal. However, at some point, you know, even those guys, you know, even the high beings and from all the different traditions, they can become the highest level bodhisattvas, but they still have a very slight obscurations still, and because of that, they cannot get truly enlightened. And to be truly enlightened, they by themselves automatically fall into the Buddhist path. So, you know, take it for what it, you know, what, you know, what it, you know. That's right. That's not to say Buddhism is any better or worse, right? He's just saying that there is one final level of understanding that's needed before one can get enlightened, right? And that is not there in other traditions, but you have to have that to, you know, to remove all your obscurations. Question?
I heard that Buddha was not Buddhist.
Yeah.
And Christ was not Christian.
Yeah.
And Mahoma was not Muslim.
Yeah. Okay, yes, you're right. Sure, you know, that is true. But that's only in this life, right? That Buddha was not a Buddhist. So what they say is that all Buddhas have followed this lineage, right, of Buddhism, you know, in the past. Right, so they have that lineage in their mind stream. So yeah, they're not Buddhas in this life. They're not Buddhists in this life, but they were Buddhists in some other life. Let's see, I'm just trying to see what else I was going to say today. Oh, one last thing, which is that, and the ultimate form of refuge is actually yourself. So all these other when you have refuge towards the Buddha, towards your guru, towards whatsoever, those are called outer objects of refuge, right? The inner object of refuge is actually yourself, because each of us has that Buddha nature, right? And because of our renunciation, if we have, you know, realized renunciation and so forth and so on, we are our own fuel, right? So we are actually, in a way, we are taking refuge in our own potential, right? So the outer objects of refuge are actually a way of, you know, seeing ourselves for who we are, right? And the potential that we are. And actually, of course, in the Vajrayana or Tantra tradition, I mean, you know, you'll have, you know, I can't speak too much about that, but that is what one is doing, right? One imagines as if that one were already enlightened, right? One acts as if. And then from that comes the actions, right? How a Buddha would act, right? So you're kind of taking refuge. So the ultimate refuge is inside, right? So that's a deep topic, you know, but I just wanted to kind of just let you know that, and that requires a lot of realization and contemplation, you know, to truly understand that. Because I remember I asked a teacher once, you know, I asked him, like, okay, so I didn't understand that ultimate refuge thing. He said, well, he said, you gotta do all this, this, and this, and this before you can really understand. I said, okay. You know. But I did understand some of it after a while. So, anyway. Any last question? Next time we'll talk about, like, you know, the qualities of the objects of refuge, you know, the objects of refuge themselves, their qualities, why they are worthy of, you know, why one should consider them objects of refuge, right? You know, what are the reasons, right? Everything has a reason in Buddhism, right? They always present it like as, here are the benefits, here are the benefits of believing in something, here are the disadvantages of not believing in that thing, and then finally, here's how to believe, right? So we've talked so far about why refuge is important. We've talked to some degree, I haven't talked about the disadvantage of not having refuge, really, but you know, that's obvious. But I've talked about the advantages of, you know, going for refuge. So next time we're going to start talking about what are the objects of refuge, why they are, and so forth, and their qualities, right? So that's next. Hey, wake up. All right. So let's wake up for the dedication at least. So I think it's on page 32. Hmm? 32, yeah. That's the one. There's one on 34 as well, but I like the 32 one. Oh, wait a minute. No, that's not the one. Sorry. Okay. The 32 one is about 36. Thank you. Pick any even number in the 30s. So at least for just a couple of seconds, just bring to our mind stream, you know, why we are studying and practicing, you know, but think about suffering, think about karma, about renunciation, why we have to get ourselves out of this, and similarly others who are suffering. So we're not doing it just for ourselves, but of benefit to all others. So with that mindset, let's do the dedication. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish but increase more and more. Actually, would you mind if we just do the two long life prayers, because we've been asked to do some prayers for Lama Zopa. So we'll just do His Holiness and Lama Zopa. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All-powerful Senrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjunath's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplish magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. Thank you very much. See you next week.